Warning: classic economic models incorporate zero variables to account for the essential role that the convivial glue of neighborly love plays in economic and social life.
Are you serious?
Welcome to the Line Go Up investment podcast.
Line, which way is it going? Up.
Up.
Real tips and tricks that you can use in your life for financial success, literacy, and winning.
This is the only podcast that will give you 100% accurate investment advice, so you're able to do things like buy a bigger house, car, maybe you could get a leisure property or a fast vehicle. And what we always say here is the more money you have, the richer you are. And that's what makes our podcast different. I think we want to start by picking up on our previous conversation, our deep and multifaceted critique of the economic literalism that has taken over our political world, who it benefits and so on. And we think before you start investing, you need to get a little bit of a background.
You really want to think about the field of economics itself critically, learn about its history, learn about its basis, learn about what's really going on.
Yeah, and that involves often busting myths. Mm-hmm. It's a house of cards. The political economic order is a house of cards. The discipline itself of economics, theoretically, if fully developed across an entire spectrum understanding of economics, is certainly its potential. It's important, but we've inherited a shriveled, I'm trying to think of the metaphor, is it culturally appropriate to say like a voodoo head? You know, a shrunken head. You remember that from like Halloween specials or whatever growing up? I don't know.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Where does that come from? What is that? I feel like there's a colonial gaze in that. We won't use that on the Line Go Up investment podcast, just in case there's probably some weird history there.
Sometimes it's best. Just leave it there.
So before the investment advice, which we give at the end of the show, we have an interview that you did earlier, and we have it on tape.
Yeah, are we breaking character now?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we are, yeah.
I'm just so confused.
We're kidding. We're not actually that. I had an idea, though, with the tape thing.
Uh-huh.
What would it sound like if I said, I've got a tape player in my butt, right? I've got a tape player in my butt. And you got a tape with the interview. Just thinking in sound design terms, I can only imagine. The audience will know. I'll be like, oh, I got a tape player in my butt. So you got a tape.
In my butt?
No, just in your hand, I think.
Oh, okay.
Unless you want to extend the bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you were saying you had a tape player in your butt and there was a tape in my butt and we had to like kiss butts.
What if you hit eject on your tape player in your butt? And then my butt was ready to receive the tape, and the tape was a color brown.
What if?
I don't know.
I don't know what that would.
But anyways, my point is I've got a tape player in my butt. You've got a tape, which is not brown. It's blue. It's like a pleasant blue. And it's the interview that you did.
Yeah, the interview.
So I'll just pull down my pants here.
Moran.
One of the ways we can play tapes at the show. And I'm really curious what this sounds like in sound design. So here's my butt, which the tape can go in. Tape popping sound. Okay, yeah, and then to make the tape play, you have to press my nipple.
And this is not, I get self-conscious about all the butts, being like, oh, this is a butt interview.
This interview has nothing to do with butts. No, I'm so sorry.
No, it's...
I feel bad now that you bring that up. Now I brought this whole thing, this whole butt thing.
No, this interview is just a fart.
Hanging away. It's not that the interview's a fart. It's that the fart is being harnessed by a machine the way that you might like squeeze the lip of a balloon to make it squeal, but in a very precise way that produces the tones.
It's a new kind of tape player.
In people's butts, yes.
Yeah.
And it's not something we were going to do every week either. So that's part of why I feel bad.
Because it's such a great interview. And
it is, yeah.
You're such a great guest.
And we didn't even think to bring up butts when you're talking about heterodox and critical economics based in like class analysis, which is what his great book did. It has nothing to do with tape players and butts. And
everything to do with economics and the world that we live in.
You know what? Forget the butt thing. Here, let me push the eject button, my other nipple. Here, take this tape back. Put it in a regular tape player. This is totally disrespectful to the guest.
We do have a normal tape player here as well. Obviously, we use it all the time. Yeah. So we'll just pop it in there.
Forget about the tape butt thing, guys.
Yeah, that isn't... It didn't even happen as far as you're concerned.
It's basically a dream sequence. It's not canon that way.
Totally.
Yeah. But we did experience it. We're not hiding.
Dreams are real in a sense.
Absolutely. Nary been said often enough, unfortunately, in this capitalist society.
Hit play. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Seriously Wrong podcast. I'm excited this week to be talking to Cahal Moran, author of a new book, Why We're Getting Poorer, but who I know initially from the YouTube channel, Unlearning Economics, which is a great resource. And yeah, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me on. I really love this podcast. I think it's one of the few good podcasts.
I don't want to cast aspersions on other podcasts, but I also agree. I like to think we're an effort posting podcast. We try to put a lot of...
Yeah, that's actually how I think about it. You do skits and you do research and you put effort into putting it together. It's not just a couple of idiots making stuff up and spreading misinformation. The bar is low, but...
The bar might be low, but we still cleared it. So, let's start with talking about the book a little bit. At the danger of oversimplifying, it feels like a lot of what you're saying here is that the problem with the economy, the reason why we're getting poorer, is the power of the ultra wealthy and the amount of control they have over the economy and therefore the political process. And that just ricochets throughout the entire world because economics, it reaches into every part of life. And this uneven economy is the title of your first chapter. The inequality that we have is a result of power being accumulated to this small group.
So my dad read the book and he said to me, it's not really about everyone getting poorer, is it? It's about a lot of people getting poorer while a very few people get much richer. So I think that's absolutely right. I think that if you were to highlight one factor that is driving a lot of these things, it is inequality. And I think, to be honest, so I finished writing the book like a year ago, pre-Trump 2.0, and this has only gotten more true, sadly, since I finished writing the book. I actually feel like I kind of understated the problem, weirdly, because there's this chapter on billionaires where I'm talking about how much control billionaires have, how they take control of their own industry, they price out competitors, and then they take control of industries that are related to it and take control of the supply chain. But then they start buying up other industries or starting other businesses or philanthropic projects that don't necessarily have anything to do with their immediate industry. And then they start buying up media and social media and then influence. And then they also start to buy influence in government. And I just think that's accelerated so much since I finished writing the book, especially in the USA. You've just seen this process unfold. And I do think that it is the source of a lot of problems. You know, we have industries that are monopolistic and they're not really fit for purpose, media organizations that are towing a specific line because they're owned by a select few people with a specific agenda. And we have extremely corrupt or at best kind of stilted government that won't go against the interests of the ultra wealthy. And not only those things, which are bad in themselves, but you've got this backlash, haven't you? You've got people understand that this is happening on some level. People understand that the elites are out of touch, they're corrupt, that things aren't working for the average person, that there's a lot of inequality, social cohesion and trust have gone down. And I think that basically this is one of the main causes of the political situation that we have now. So yeah, I do think if I had to highlight one aspect of the global economy, and it's not just billionaires, right? It's just inequality in itself. We still have an immense amount of poverty in the world that is simply solvable. There are so many trials. Maybe we didn't need rigorous randomized control trials to show this, but we have them now that show that, you know, if you give poor people money, oh my God, they stop being poor. It's incredible because now they have the money to afford things, right? And that has a whole bunch of positive knock-on effects. It doesn't have any of the negative effects that people worry about. You know, they stay at home or smoke loads of cigarettes or whatever. So by reducing inequality, by reining in the rich and powerful and redistributing from them to the poor, we could solve so many of our problems. And I regard it as a great failure, a great moral failure, to be honest, let alone economic, but a great moral failure that we just continue not to do so.
Yeah, what's happening in the States right now is crazy with Elon Musk and Trump and like Peter Thiel and J.D. Vance. They've been so cushy and close, and the U.S. has been terrible for allowing major mergers of giant companies to happen for like decades now. But under Trump, it's gotten even worse. They're letting like even these few remaining media companies, many of them are trying to merge now. And yeah, the political power of the wealthy has never been like so in your face.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I go into it in chapter two, this notion of antitrust law. And this is an idea from economics, the Chicago School of Economics, which is quite free market. But they basically said, look, monopoly isn't a problem if the price is low. So the idea is that in a monopoly, they're going to raise prices above the competitive level, you'll rip off consumers. And therefore, if you have a situation where there's quite a large firm, but they're not increasing prices, then there's not really a problem, right? Like a high price is a symptom of monopoly, and equally low prices must mean that there's some kind of competition, even if they're a large firm. Maybe they're worried about new entrants or whatever. But what this missed, I think, was all of the power that accrues to large firms and their owners outside of just being able to increase the price. And a lot of the basic Econ 101 models focus on just price, really. But there are a whole load of things that they can do. They can exploit and squeeze small suppliers. They can price competitors out of the market. They can exploit and squeeze their workers, the environment, and of course, the wealth and power that the owners have can also then accrue influence and political power. And that's something that was understood by the older idea of antitrust, like in the era of Theodore Roosevelt and trust busting. It was said, the Sherman Act, the creator of the Sherman Act, I forget his first name, but he said, if we would not tolerate a dictator in the sphere of politics, why in economics? Why would we allow one man to run all of our rail infrastructure, all of our oil fields, right? In these days, it would be like all of our kind of internet infrastructure. Why would we allow that? We don't allow dictators in the political sphere, so not we shouldn't in the economic sphere. But that's a much more general point than just, is the price high or low? And that's something that's been really missed. And I do think that you could place the blame for this situation to some extent on that school of antitrust and on the economists who promoted it, because they don't think about politics that much historically. And as a result, they've just missed all of these brewing problems, all of the massive power that a lot of these companies have accrued. Because if you look at Amazon, like prices in Amazon are obviously quite low. Like they're low enough to usually not attract the attention of the competition authorities. But Jeff Bezos has built an empire. He owns so many different things that aren't necessarily even directly related to Amazon. I mean, he bought the Washington Post, for example. And that in itself should be unacceptable.
Yeah, the idea that it's okay to have one person controlling Amazon, even like this huge distribution company, or one person controlling Google, or a small group of people, the board or whatever, as long as they keep prices low, is like missing the point fundamentally. This complete disregard for power and for what it means in the world. And if they have the power to keep the prices low, then you're giving them the power to increase them. The problem with having a king or queen ruling over people, a dictator, isn't just that it's fine as long as they do good things, and then we just hope that the next ruler also does good things. And if they ever don't, then it becomes a problem. The whole point behind like democracy and wanting to distribute power more evenly amongst people is to avoid that kind of situation in the first place, and to let people have a say in the things that affect their lives. And like any huge company like this has such a profound impact on the planet, the economy, the ecology all around the world. Like the idea that can just be a completely privately run thing, a little dictatorship of the CEO and the board or whatever it's a wild political idea that people don't have to like defend on those terms a lot of the time.
It's no coincidence that the workplaces in Amazon are actually quite Orwellian. You're talking about workers who are constantly monitored, who are underpaid and overworked. They have absolutely ridiculous targets. They have no time. That you hear talk of them like wetting themselves and things like that, right? It is a dictatorship. It's a workplace economic dictatorship. And you could say something similar for the way that a lot of phones and electronics are constructed, like in China and Taiwan, right? You really are. It's not just an analogy. It is quite simply a condition where a small group of people or one person has a lot of control over other people through economic compulsion. And I don't know what else to call it than dictatorship.
I'm kind of interested, like, how someone who goes to school to become an economist comes out the other end, creating a YouTube channel called Unlearning Economics and writing a book that's a little bit on the fringe of what a lot of economists think. And I know you've published a previous book to this that was like a report that you did as part of a student group. And so I'm just kind of your motivation, what you're doing and why.
My lore, basically.
Yeah, the lore.
Yeah. So I started to study economics initially just out of curiosity when I was 16, sort of, what is this subject? But I came of age during the 2008 crisis. It was like September 2007, just as I was beginning to study at A-level, and Northern Rock in the UK collapsed. And I remember my tutor commenting like, oh, this is a horrible thing. This is going to be a big recession, but it's a really interesting time to study economics. And that stuck with me because I thought, oh, wow, there's this big crisis that nobody really saw coming. It seems like it's going to be really bad. Nobody really fully understands it. And clearly, economics is this subject that is worth studying. And it seems to matter to everyone. It seems to affect everyone. And furthermore, there's obviously a lot that we don't really understand about it. So that emboldened me to pursue it at university level. But I think one thing that was very clear from early on, and A-levels weren't too bad, high school, but when I was studying at university, and it was clear that we were just not really learning anything that was connected to the real world. It was very strange, actually, because you're talking early 2010s. You had the peak of the Eurozone crisis. You had riots in Athens, and none of it was even mentioned in our courses. And the financial crisis wasn't mentioned in our courses, and the climate crisis wasn't mentioned, and inequality wasn't mentioned. If they were, it was only very much in passing. We just spent all of our time solving this abstract theory. So it was quite an odd thing to go into economics in the hope that now I can make sense of what comes through the news, the economic news. Maybe I'll be able to make some predictions and my family can ask me around the dinner table, you know, what is going on with the economy? What do you think is going to happen? To return from a year, 2 years, 3 years of education and be none the wiser, to not have any ability to answer those questions is extremely embarrassing and also quite strange. So I think quite a lot of students in my cohort had the same feelings independently. And I don't just mean at Manchester where I was. I mean that these student groups sprung up across the country, across the world, saying, where's the economics in our economics education? Why aren't we learning anything about the real world? And you mentioned my first book. That's how this entire project was born, and it's still going, and it's under an umbrella organization called Rethinking Economics now. And so that was the first book, was to say, the economy is really important. Look at all this stuff that's going on. A lot of it seems not to be going very well. Economists seem to be very important. They're very influential. But why are their ideas failing us? Why are their ideas so bad? Why is the education not fit for purpose? And it was about trying to reform the economics profession and to make it more democratic, more pluralist, more accountable, I think, especially when it was implementing policies that affected people's lives. So that was the more academic side of it, you could say, or the side of it that's focused on the economics profession. But what the new book is, I think, for me, and this is how it started, by the way, before it got its current title, Why We're Getting Poorer, I think it was called just Unlearning Economics, What I Wish I'd Learned in My Economics Degree. So this was literally me filling the gap and saying, I would have loved to have had a book like this when I was studying to actually just get an idea of what is the economy like? How do we measure it? What's capitalism? How did that emerge? What is going on with inequality? What is going on with different markets and industries, housing? All of these questions that are on people's lips when they think about the economy, I wanted to explore them, and not from kind of a mainstream theoretical perspective necessarily, but just from one grounded in history and in statistics, and just seemed like a fairly, what I would call a realistic approach that would chime with that kind of almost naive understanding of, I want to understand what's going on in the news. And that was what I wanted. So this is what this book tries to do in some small way. So I do feel like you're right to draw them together, because it's all connected, right? This project to demystify economics and communicate it to the public, but without the baggage of some of these ideas from economic theory that I really think have outlived their usefulness.
We now go to an economics classroom where students are learning the craft from their teacher.
All right, class. Today we're going to be covering the craft of economics, graphs, and spreadsheets. Most critically, today we're going to be talking about hypothetical and imaginary graphs and spreadsheets.
Teacher, yes?
Yeah, I was wondering if we're going to be talking about what's happening in the news.
In the news?
Yeah, you know, the economic issues that are affecting people.
It's not today, at the very least. Like I said, we're talking about graphs, but not a graph that reports something that's been measured in the world, but actually a graph that shows a hypothetical intersection between principles. So we're going to start there. Everyone open up your textbook. Now there's an imaginary and hypothetical spreadsheet on page 18. And I want everyone to just recognize that it's basically as real as anything. It is as real as the shoes on our feet. It's as real as the chairs underneath our butts.
Teacher, I was wondering if you could explain why my dad lost his job recently.
It's not on the agenda for today, but usually it's because they're lazy or a bad worker.
If we learn about the graph, will that help people in the real world fix their lives or make them better?
What are you...
His dad's not the only... If you look outside the window there, people are lined up for unemployment, soup kitchens.
No, I don't even... You might as well have been speaking French or something.
Isn't that related to economics? What's going on outside? No.
Yeah, okay, look, this isn't a what's happening in the real world outside the window, if you just look, class. That's more like painting, maybe, or high-effort podcasting or something. This is an economics class. We study graphs, spreadsheets
teacher,
that are hypothetical.
Do we never look at the economy, like the actual economy?
Yeah, the way it is right now?
Yeah, in a way, we are doing that. So,
what way? Because it seems like we're not.
Look, you kid, you don't understand economics, okay? You should be a little more embarrassed to ask questions like this, because it's just showing to me that you're so contemptible in a way, from an economic point of view.
So if we're looking at these models,
yes,
are they models of the real world?
No, you don't understand economics so much. It pisses me off. You shut up from now on, because it's so I'm trying to teach up here. You shouldn't even be part of the conversation asking these kind of questions. You're not serious.
What does GDP mean?
I don't know, okay? But other people do. And they're very serious and very important.
Look, my uncle said economists are just failed mathematicians. Is that true?
I don't know, okay?
My aunt said economists failed mathematicians with no social skills. Is that true?
If it's not on the page, I don't know, all right?
If I solve the model, will my dad be able to feed us again? Should I show the graph to my dad?
Yes! Okay? Oh my god, that's a great question. Thank you. Yes, it will. Your dad needs to learn this. Okay, now, please. Eyes away from the window. Eyes away from the real world. Page 18. Hypothetical imaginary graph from our imaginations that makes us happy, okay? And it justifies everything. You just have to believe that someone understands why.
as an outsider looking in, someone who's never formally studied economics, generally, if I look into some academic discipline, trying to figure out the answer to a question to what people are studying, maybe there's like complicated details or some counterintuitive findings or things that are difficult or don't quite make sense, but you can usually like muddle through as an interested layman and kind of be like, okay, I understand how this was all arrived at. This makes sense. But every time I try doing that with economic stuff, you end up hitting this bedrock of this assumption, or there's a model that if this increases, this goes down, and that will always happen. But like the real world is so much more complicated than that, that anytime that doesn't actually play out in the real world, you can just say, oh, well, some other factor must have come into play here, but the theory still holds true. And it gives me such anxiety talking about it, even though we've come out pretty hard in certain episodes about specific things. I feel all this like sense of imposter syndrome, being like, oh, no, entire academic discipline doesn't get it.
I mean, I understand your feelings. You know, I go back and forth on this question as well, because on the one hand, I cite a lot of economic research in the book. Generally, when I cite economic research, it's usually of the statistical kind, like what we call applied economics, where it's like, okay, they put a carbon tax in Sweden, how much did it reduce emissions? And there's some kind of pretty solid statistical work that's done under the general rubric of economics. So I do tend to cite that kind of stuff. But when you get to some of the theory and some of the more abstract stuff, you do just have that general feeling that what are they thinking? They're just playing with these toy models, and there's no real guarantee that what they're saying has anything to do with the real world. And it just often feels like a bit of an intellectual parlor game. There's that term idiot savant, right? Which is just where you're really good at something very specific and niche, but you don't really understand the rest of the world. And I do think it was almost made for economics, because a lot of economists will know economic models inside out better than you or me, but they can't think outside of that kind of model. And it's like optimal control theory, right? They usually use like optimizing, maximizing mathematics, and they talk about equilibrium and stuff. And if you start to show them some other way of doing things, whether that's maybe that's a bit more historical or institutional, like my book, or maybe it's like a Marxist approach, or maybe there's like other approaches in complexity theory or whatever. If you start to show them something else, they can't really comprehend it, and they start trying to fit it back into their framework, and they just won't accept anything that doesn't abide by the core tenets of economic modeling. But there's not a lot of reflection on like the philosophical basis for that modeling.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, the real world data stuff can be super useful, but then yeah, some of the arguments they make from it will go back to those models again or rely on it for the interpretation. And like so much political stuff gets mixed into it without the acknowledgement that there's like political positioning happening here, that we're assuming that this thing is good because we're lumping it in under efficiency, or yeah, using these words. And when you pull it apart, what it means in the real world isn't what the layman might think.
I always find it amazing, this distinction between positive and normative economics. It's what you're talking about, right? It's like just the idea that we can just analyze reality from like a positivist perspective, right? Positive economics, and we just say, this is what happens, we're not judging it at all. And then there's normative economics where we're saying, this is what happens, and we think that's good. And I understand that there is a distinction there in some ways, whether you're doing like outright advocacy or doing some analysis. But at the end of the day, so many economics papers end with a policy prescription, and it might be like targeting, trying to increase efficiency or growth, like you said. So many of them end with a policy prescription that I just think like there's really, in practice, there's no separation between positive and normative. Like, you are telling us things that you think are good. Or they'll say something like, a policy is welfare enhancing. And they're like, oh, that's just a descriptive term. Oh, welfare enhancing, that's not loaded at all. And I just think it's that there's all of these implicit assumptions about what is good and how the economy should work and which policies we should have, sometimes explicit assumptions. And it just often goes unexamined, and it's thought that we're just doing positive economics when we really aren't.
There's another chapter, really great examination of one of these myths or assumptions that you come across in economics all the time, which is that the people who accumulate all this power, all this wealth, do so through their own merit. It's because they earned it. Elon Musk just did a billion times more work than someone who has a couple hundred dollars to their name. And it's just fair. What are you going to do? You're going to take his well-earned wealth away from him? And it sounds ridiculous to even say it, but so many people believe it and defend it. And yeah, why isn't that true?
Yeah, when you think about it for a minute, it's clearly ridiculous as a conclusion. But I do think that a lot of people believe that if you've made some money, if you've been successful with a business, or maybe you are an employee, but a high paid one, then you have in some way earned it because in some way you've created that wealth. And it's what you call in statistics a survivorship bias, right? Because all you're seeing are the successful people. It's like if you concluded that buying lottery tickets will make you rich just by looking at lottery winners, right? There's so many different factors that go into this, luck being a really huge one. And Elon Musk in particular has had a lot of lucky breaks. He received government funding, for instance. And I think Tesla was basically on the verge of bankruptcy before he got that green energy loan from Obama. So people who are that wealthy have a lot of lucky breaks. They have a lot of privileges as well, which is something that the chapter goes into in detail. Certain individuals face a lot of discrimination, a lot of barriers that other individuals don't. And yeah, you just can't infer from a selected outcome, only part of the picture, that the actions they took inevitably led them to success, because there's going to be a whole lot of people who didn't succeed, who took very similar actions. And that's what you need to be looking at to really understand, like, how do people get rich and wealthy? And returning to the point about privileges and discrimination, when you look in depth at how people get jobs, right, how their earnings are decided, if you look in depth at, like, the effects of class and poverty on people, you see there's some really almost inarguable evidence for this, that people just face discrimination and some people have much lower chances than others. And therefore, it's just ridiculous to conclude that those who rise to the top are simply those who are smartest or who produce the best product or who work the hardest or what have you.
It turns into this area of economics, or like behavioral economics sometimes, that can be used to justify really harsh views on people's inborn abilities in ways that, even if you're running an experiment, you're completely ignoring all the context surrounding it. Like the part where you're talking about the marshmallow test, which is something that you hear about all the time. It's like, oh, if you give kids, you put them in a room on a table with a marshmallow in front and you tell them, wait 5 minutes or 2 minutes and I'll come back and you can have two marshmallows. The kids who are able to wait, who have that self-control, end up doing better in life. So, you know, it's there from when they're kids, that ability to defer gratification and make those smart decisions. But they're completely ignoring that those kids come from totally different environments with totally different relationships to food and precarity. And the reason that some kids have a hard time waiting might not be because they have some inborn trait that makes them poor genetically. It might be that living in a poor environment makes you more anxious and you just want to eat the marshmallow right away because you're not sure that it's going to stick around.
Yeah, totally. And you can go even further than what you were implying, I think, because it's actually, if you live in a very poor, uncertain environment where there's not a lot of resources, where authority figures are maybe fleeting or they don't keep their promises, where you're moving around a lot, the idea that you would wait for the second marshmallow in that test is actually quite ridiculous. It's actually completely irrational. No, you take what you can get. And that is just the sensible thing to do in certain circumstances. And that is my favorite variant of the marshmallow test, because I do think that there was this narrative that persisted for a long time, because it came out in the 60s first, the marshmallow test. And it was like, well, look, poorer people are just impatient and that's why they're poor. But no, you're impatient because you're poor. You're not poor because you're impatient. There are all sorts of effects of being poor on people's behavior, that being poor reduces your cognitive bandwidth. It gives you a lot less time and energy to make long-term planning decisions. You have to focus on the here and now. It does seem to affect people's like cognitive ability as well. When they're poor, you can study like when they're temporarily poor, people's cognitive ability seems to go down. There's so many different effects here that it's just completely ridiculous to, it's a simple confusion of correlation and causation, right? To say that impatience causes being poor. It's actually the other way around.
And it seems so obvious if you're not going in with this motivated desire to justify how things are.
Can I also add something there to what we were saying a little bit about class and race and gender and the economics profession too, and academia, because these tests were originally done by psychologists, I think. And it is interesting that you're talking about a type of study that is done by people who have been born into quite a good situation, maybe into an academic family, they've never experienced poverty, and they're carrying out these tests. And it takes decades before some people who have actually experienced poverty, who maybe aren't white, who maybe don't have academics in their family, for them to come along and say, oh no, maybe it's this, because they understand that background. So it's like those studies were so slow to respond to these basic insights that everybody in poverty knows, everybody in poverty would understand this. But because academia and policymaking have been populated by relative elites for so long, they just haven't understood it and they had to be told.
The other part of the meritocracy stuff that just really hit home for me, because I've also read this book. You mentioned Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. And yeah, we talk about all these people doing all this hard work, building companies, creating all this value. But the 4-Hour Workweek was like one of the original like drop shipping bro manuals. Like, you can make a lot of money by doing drop shipping, basically. He had some other stuff in there, other advice, other ideas, but that was a big part of it.
Sorry, what's drop shipping?
Oh, sorry. Drop shipping is when you sell you set up an online storefront that people send the orders to you, and then you send the order to the company that's actually selling it. And
oh, like his pills, like his focus pills or whatever he was selling. Okay.
And he's like, yeah, this is how you set up an online business. You don't have to produce anything. You don't have to do anything, really. You just hire people to deal with the customer complaints and set up this storefront. One of the major points you make is that a big piece of advice he gives in that book is to hire people on Upwork or like these online sites in other countries where they have lower wages to do basically all of the work for you.
Well, yeah, your first question about this chapter was literally like, why haven't rich people necessarily earned their wealth? Here's your answer, right? Not everybody can do this. This relies on you self-avowedly, right? That you're exploiting workers in poorer countries. That's what he recommends. He recommends moving to another country and benefiting from a generous exchange rate, which is obviously something only available to people in richer countries, if even they want to do that. But then hiring people in poorer countries to do all the work for you. And I mean, that book is ridiculous. I actually don't think it gets enough hate. I know it's had a little bit more hate recently, but like at one point, there's a chapter that's written by one of these assistants.
Yeah.
Or like a section. And he's just got someone else to write it. And it's like, you're scamming me while I'm reading this. You didn't write that. And you're telling me you're scamming me while I'm reading it. It's incredible. I actually can't believe how much traction it got. Because it's just completely ridiculous advice that is obviously not generalizable, because the assistants can't hire assistants to do everything for them. And it depends on this massive pay differential between countries. So yeah, it's quite strange because it's only 2011, but it feels like it comes from a completely different age, that book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people read it and got starry-eyed, imagining that they too can be one of these scammers at the top of the little pyramid of foreign faceless workers on an online site who do all the work for you.
Well, it is a pyramid scheme, isn't it? A veiled pyramid scheme.
It's definitely scammy. And it, I mean, all companies in a Marxist sense are a bit of a pyramid scheme. They're scraping money off of people, moving it up to the top, but yeah.
Oh, man.
Another wonderful day on the floor.
Non-stop action.
I love working at the stock market.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some people say that we're just flipping around imaginary fragments of ideas as middlemen in a non-contributing way, and that we're too powerful by the wealth that we have, out of touch.
What?
And to those people, I just simply say, shut up.
There's so much that they just don't understand.
See, look at this guy, for example, sweeping the floor. All the things he doesn't understand that we do.
He's just sweeping, but we could hire 1,000 sweepers.
Yeah, he sucks.
You know, I heard this person once said that GDP isn't a measurement of the health of a society because more medical spending could mean more sick people, or a war could increase weapons manufacturing to a massive degree. That's like not a good thing. And I was just like, what are you talking about?
We're bringing the moralism into it. Yeah. But that's often a big mistake.
Yeah, this is objective.
Well, GDP is good because if it goes up, then the economy grows. So the economy is bigger because GDP is bigger.
Exactly. That's what they don't get. The bigness.
These maniacs, they want a small economy. They'll stop at nothing to keep an economy like a bonsai tree to shrink and shrink. Rick Moranis. They're Rick Moranis. Mm. They want to shrink the economy.
Yeah. Honey, I shrunk the economy.
It's sick. Now, I was just thinking about some of the things not reflected on the balance sheets or made invisible in analysis as unpaid labor, including domestic labor, especially according to like gendered lines. Also, power itself. There's very powerful people, like top level stock banking guys. They can shape the banking rules for their own benefit to make more money. And that obviously doesn't have any place on a regular spreadsheet showing line go up.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it all happens against the backdrop of the police that protect us here trading, the military that protects our economy standing in the global world and empowers us to spend more, have a growing economy under the threat of military force. I was just thinking about how all those things are not on the balance sheet. And I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think any of that stuff matters.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some airy fairy way in which it matters, but in terms of the hard, cold graph itself, it's, I don't even see where you would put it on the graph. So what is even the point in bringing all that up?
Well, it's airy fairy. I think that's exactly right. It's a form of self-expression that basically comes from art students. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was reminded when you said the word airy fairy, the climate, the environment, the material resource base of the planet, other things that we shouldn't reflect because it's a little bit cringe. It's cringe and it's art school.
People in art school have probably never even made a line go up in their lives.
Except for parental disappointment lines.
and they've never thought about what goes into a price. Price encapsulates all of that, really. Resource base, whatever things you said, I forget already. But
prices communicate information perfectly about everything all the time. That's what we know.
Mm-hmm.
The price is always right.
Yes, thank you. There's a reason that show is named that.
It was trying to uphold the economic order. The price is right. It reflects every aspect of information that would be required. And that's what Bob Barker was trying to say all those years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, subtly, but
consistently.
He got it. One thing that's weird, talking about what value means as economists, and then when I go home talking to normies, they'll say things like, oh, I value my friendship or the love of my family. And I'm like, what do you mean? Those... What number do you even put on that?
Is this like, jazz night? Can we get a spreadsheet together?
That's not value. That's not what value means.
Maybe if you plotted the number of friends you had on a graph and the line went up, then maybe.
Mm-hmm. I could see that, but none of these people are doing that.
They're all art students.
Yeah, and jealous. Right. Jealous as well of various things.
Everyone I see, I just am thinking that a lot. Oh, they're jealous of me. That janitor we walked by earlier, jealous of me. The person working there in that coffee stand, jealous of me.
That's good.
It's not easy, but
it makes them aspire, right? The jealousy, now it can obviously be very annoying, but in the best case, it makes them aspire. Maybe that janitor is going to go home and he's going to say, what capital can I get together to get in on this action? To get these calluses on my hands to slowly become soft and plush, ready to buy and sell. That's the kind of aspirational thing that I think we can just do by walking by and making maybe a small comment to him, like, you missed a spot.
Do you guys ever worry that someone like that maybe wouldn't have access to capital because of their class?
I have no idea what that means.
No, that's stupid. Again, I said that. Again, I said that's embarrassing. But I said that. Of course, he has access to capital.
He could go to a bank.
Of course, he has access to capital.
If he has an idea worth funding, just bring it to a venture capitalist.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, he could get an angel investor or something.
Just get them on the phone.
Exactly.
I think the issue with those types, like the janitors of the world, is misallocation of capital. When they get that startup fund from their parents when they're 17 or 18, like all of us, mm-hmm. they get an arcade machine and they let people access it for free, not even for a quarter. And that's what causes economies to fall. So I think it's for the best. It's more money for us downstream as they waste it and spend it out there instead of investing
and going out carousing or whatever they're doing.
Exactly, carousing. And a good chunk of our income actually comes from the carousing class, and then they can get a piece of it back when they shine the shoes or whatever. There's the other thing too, is like we're always seeking more financial efficiency. And then my kid, he's so precocious, 8 years old. I wish I had more time to spend with him, but I'm here. He said once to me, "Dad, there's different types of efficiency. There's not just the efficiency for the lowest cost. There's also the efficiency of materials use, time spent by human beings, environmental efficiency or energy efficiency, all these different types of childish efficiencies," he was listing off to me. And I said, "Son, study prices."
Yeah.
"And then come back to me."
I can't believe he's asking those questions.
It was about 4 weeks ago we had this conversation. I haven't had a chance to connect with him since. But I'd imagine that he's probably there now, yeah.
I'd say that you need to spend more time with him teaching him, but obviously you don't. Obviously you should stay here, but maybe you should hire someone to teach him about prices while you're here.
Yeah, because I've got two sons. I've got my child son and I've got my portfolio. And there's some things that are more important or valuable than human relationships.
You can't put an economic value on a person, but you can put it on a portfolio. So it's just clear which one matters more.
Yeah,
of course. Have you guys ever noticed how all the markets, like the ones that we work in, if you look at history, they really often crash and bubbles pop and it destroys entire economies?
Yeah, I mean,
I guess that's different.
It is the way it is, and they probably didn't do the right things. And
those economies weren't run by alphas.
That's not going to happen to us.
It's the information age now. We're on eBay. True. We're sending MSNs. It's a different world. I think also we know how to separate the wheat from the chaff better. A lot of those economies were probably run by airy-fairy art school types who weren't hard-nosed.
Didn't even know what a derivative is.
Right, yeah. They had no means to swap complex financial instruments at all.
Right.
I wouldn't take their advice on how to tie my shoes.
Have you guys ever thought about how, like, a lot of what we do, trading options, the derivatives and stuff we mentioned, it was all considered gambling and in history fairly recently, not allowed?
It's not gambling if you win every time.
Right. Right. Is the casino gambling when people gamble at the casino?
Obviously not.
The lobbies gamble.
The janitor gambles.
Yeah, I'll bet he's going to gamble right now.
Another thing, no, this was bugging me. And I just need a sanity check. Have you guys noticed for the last little while, housing prices have been like significantly exceeding economic and wage growth?
My portfolio noticed, yeah.
And the mortgage industry has been giving out these like risky subprime mortgages to people who probably can't afford to pay them back because the financial incentive is such that they make more money by doing that. There's also an issue with the ratings agency giving these loans, AAA rating, that we've got a derivatives market that's built on repackaging those alleged AAA loans that are actually faulty subprime mortgages in a way that's really like generally embedded in the overall economy, like obviously making a lot of money off of it. But I was thinking, like, is that a problem, or is that, do we have to worry about that?
No, you're living in the past, man. It's not the 1980s. This is 2008.
Living in 2008, very beginning of 2008, we can all say very clearly that it's working and things are going great. And I love it.
Nothing's ever going to change for the worse.
Like Flo Rida says in Low, which is all over the radio right now, "This crazy all night, spending my dough. Had $1 million vibe and a bottle to go."
Oh, he
hits home.
Flo Rida makes the line go up.
He skipped art school for sure.
She threw it back at me. I gave her more. "Cash ain't no problem. I know where it goes."
Do you think he's maybe also a derivatives trader, Flo Rida, with lyrics that relevant?
Oh, I think so. He's been sending me a lot of cryptic messages through his songs.
That's really relevant because that song's so popular right now. I love working in financial markets in 2008.
Oh, me too. It's the end of history.
Yeah.
Financial markets in 2008. It's going to be like this forever. Never seen that make me go.
never know. And $1 million vibe in the body to go.
So the book's called Why We're Getting Poorer, and there's some debate as to how true that is, whether we're getting poorer or whether everybody's always getting richer, the tides are lifting all boats, we're at the best time in human history, global poverty has never been lower, the poorest person in America today has luxuries the kings of old could never even dream about. These are some things that I can imagine people saying to the title of your book without having read it.
Yeah, it is the dominant counter narrative, and it's sometimes called like new optimism. And I do think you could read my book as a response to new optimism, because I think that there's something very crucial they're missing. And it's worth saying that it's not necessarily either or. There are some things that I find very encouraging. One of the main ones is like the progress in basic vaccinations and like infant mortality and things like that. I do think that's something which has changed a lot for the better over the past few decades. And it's actually quite remarkable, because infant mortality, I think it's one of the few things where you can safely say it was the norm for a lot of human history. Like a lot of children did just die, a really large proportion of them. And now that's not the case even in quite poor countries. So I do think that that's quite incredible. And I do very much believe in the power of science and medicine and policies. And, you know, maybe even business to some extent to try and achieve these gains and maintain them. But one of the things about the new optimist narrative is that it's just way, way too triumphalist. They celebrate this massive reduction in poverty. And the measure that they use, this $2.15 a day poverty line, which is what, like almost $800 a year, right? So it's really not very much money at all. That poverty line was not really constructed based on anything serious. It was cobbled together a few decades ago, and they didn't have a lot of the data available. So I think it's when you see that kind of poverty has declined like this, it's a bit spurious. I don't think it's really based on very good data. But I think more importantly, I don't think that new optimists are getting at what a good life is, what the experience of making ends meet, what the experience of poverty actually is like for a lot of people. Because while there has been generalized material progress, a lot of things have kind of fallen by the wayside for people. And things like housing, access to housing, things like stable employment, things like being able to raise a family, things like healthcare and education. What you're seeing with these is that sometimes the quality is going down or the availability is going down. Sometimes the price is going up, and those are the things that matter the most to people. And if you look at, we were talking about Amazon earlier, right? It's undeniable that Amazon provides us with a lot of low-cost consumer goods that are delivered very quickly, really convenient to buy. Basically, any little bit of tap that enters your mind, you can order it on Amazon. It might be with you the same day, right? And that's one of the sources of this kind of general growth and economic progress. But it doesn't really matter as much to people as like some of those more fundamental things, the essentials, the basic needs that I mentioned earlier. And I think that new optimists, I just don't see much of an attempt to grapple with this problem. What does matter to people? What has happened to those things, right? And like I said, I don't think they're entirely wrong. The world's complicated. Some things get better, some things get worse, some things maybe stay the same. But ultimately, why are people so unhappy with the state of the economy? Why are people so unhappy politically? All of these things have declined and people are just finding it harder to make ends meet. And the one final thing is what you said at the start of this interview is inequality as well. Now, Steven Pinker in particular has to dismiss inequality as a problem because it's something that has clearly gotten worse over the past few decades. And so to fit his kind of narrative of everything's getting better, he has to say this has gotten more severe, but it doesn't matter really. There's not actually a problem with inequality. But there is such a lot of evidence that inequality has a negative effect on people's well-being, that inequality causes a whole range of like health problems, things like crime. And even in a situation where it seems like poverty statistics are declining somewhat, even in a situation where GDP is going up, where unemployment is quite low, and even maybe something like literacy is going up, you can have what's been called Brazilianization, where you've got quite a wealthy elite living in private fortresses who are protected from the rest of the population who are just scraping by
day-to-day in unemployment or underemployment, and they don't have access to good housing, and they don't necessarily have access to good public services. Those two are entirely compatible, right? So I think you miss a lot of the texture and detail of what is making people unhappy and what people are worried about by just looking at this kind of line goes up.
Yeah, where you collapse all of these different things into one number and say that the number went up, so it got better, people have more wealth now, or the amount of people under $2 a day is lower. Like, having more access to certain consumer goods can feel meaningless when you're like, oh, I don't know if I can make rent this month. I can definitely pay my phone bill, and I get the newest iPhone every 2 years because it comes with the plan or whatever, they let you upgrade. And in one sense, I'm super rich. I have this amazing piece of technology. But you know, in the 1960s and 70s, we had a lot of public housing in Canada, and the federal government funded a lot of public housing that was available for people who needed it. And even the small city I grew up in, it was 50,000 when I was a kid. I don't know what it was in the 70s, but there was public housing there. And there's, in the 1970s, they didn't have these phones, they didn't have Amazon, they didn't have a whole bunch of cool stuff that we have right now. But people in Canada had a lot more access to cheap, available public housing, and also non-public housing that then has to compete with the public housing, and it gets cheaper. So yeah, housing's a big topic core to this feeling that we're getting poorer, because it's one of the things that's increased the most above other things in the inflation index. And it's one of the most fundamental things. It's having a place to stay, a roof over your head. So that collapsing of all these different things into one metric just loses sight of so much of what's important to people.
To this point as well, if you take someone without a home, a rough sleeper, not just someone without a home, in Canada or the UK or the US, they wouldn't be deemed in poverty by this line. Because if you're begging, you might get a few dollars, pounds a day. You know what I mean? You're going to get that amount, but then you're deemed not in poverty by that line, or even by a slightly higher line, maybe even by $10 a day, you're not in poverty because you're getting that from begging. And then you buy a sandwich or whatever. So that strikes me as quite absurd. And I do think that universal poverty line has quite a lot of trouble being applied to the specific context of each country. But yeah, more generally, housing, I do think that it may be the most important thing, like you said, for this feeling of people getting poorer and, oh, I can't even have financial security and somewhere to live. My landlord has control over my rent and I'm moving every few years. How am I going to start a family if I have this level of instability? One of the things that kind of motivated the title was the chief economist of the Bank of England, Hugh Pill, said that Britons need to accept that they are poorer. That's it. Those were his words. And this was during the cost of living crisis, which was maybe a 20 to 30% hit to most people's standard of living. But then what we did, right, across the world was we increased interest rates. Now, interest rates, it's no secret that they mostly affect housing. And housing, like you said, is the main expenditure for people. So the way that we try to address inflation, the way that we deal with a cost of living crisis, is by increasing the cost of living. And that just made things even worse for a lot of people. I mean, it works, you know, inverted commas, in the sense that it does bring inflation down, but it seems to solve the disease of inflation by killing the patient. And it's amazing that we're just squeezing people more and more. And now housing is already a big expense, but for a lot of people, it's maybe taking up half of their budget. And the Bank of England deliberately decides to squeeze you when it wants to reduce inflation, they increase your housing costs. This entire system, this entire way we manage the macroeconomy and housing and how they're linked, it just seems fundamentally broken to me.
The idea that, again, I'm not, and I don't know, I understand how all this works, but if you're going to do that and increase the price of housing through this adjustment of the interest rates, wouldn't you also want some other kind of policy to make sure that the most vulnerable people's housing doesn't also increase, that you're taking this extra money out of the economy more primarily from the people who can afford to give it? and maybe even redistributing it to people who need to spend it, who will actually pump it back into the economy. I don't
know. See, now you're making a normative statement. You know, that's not allowed.
No, I'm just saying, if you did that, wouldn't it make one of the lines go up? A good line?
A more holistic approach to managing inflation and managing the macroeconomy is something that I advocate for in the book. It's not something that I go into a great deal of detail about, but I do think that having ways of buying and selling land, buying and selling housing, provisioning credit is something that East Asian economies tend to do a bit better than Western ones, making sure that there is some housing provision for people so that they don't fall through the cracks is just absolutely indispensable.
We did that rent control episode recently talking about the arguments against it, and there's a lot of arguments against it, but a big one is under this umbrella of regulations are bad. We shouldn't add new regulations unless they're like absolutely necessary. But a point that you make in this book that's like just so obvious or seems so obvious is that the economy is regulations. It's built on rules and regulations that exist within the context of a state with a government that's applying rules to the economy. So the question isn't, should we have regulations? It's, what are the regulations and who are they favoring and what are they doing?
Housing, I don't know if there's a better example than land or housing of what you're saying. There's no such thing as a free market because the property rights around housing are so complicated. It's not just like you either own it or you don't, right? It's like you've got the landlord and the tenant, and you've also got a mortgage and the bank, and all of them have a very complex set of like rights and responsibilities that differ over time and place. And there are certain things that the landlord isn't allowed to do. It's their house technically, but they're not allowed to be physically in it if they're not living there. They're not allowed to be physically in it very often. That's not permitted. It's like the tenants to live in, even if it technically belongs to the landlord. All of these laws, right, they do change. I thought, yeah, I really enjoyed that rent control episode. I thought it was a really good example of what we were actually talking about earlier, when you've got some like good empirical work that just looks at like statistics on housing availability and how it was affected by this rent control law. But then you've got this interpretation that's like entirely econ brained and ideological. And just like, sometimes I think you found it was contradictory. Like sometimes it seems like the same thing's good and bad, depending on which side of their mouth they're talking out of. And yeah, this interpretation of this like rent control law as being universally bad, when just to take an example, it leads to landlords selling up to either other landlords or to first time home buyers, right? And it's, that could be interpreted as a good thing, but it's thought of as just a bad thing. And I think with rent control and tenants' rights more generally, there is just this question of, yeah, like, you're the tenant, you are living there. What kind of rights do you have over like the price of it, over like what you're allowed to do with the property, over what other people are allowed to do with the property? And that's just something that, for instance, in this rent control paper about San Francisco that I was alluding to, they just don't go into it at all. And they don't look at how in San Francisco, it's very easy to evict tenants. And so they say this rent control law caused tenants to basically be evicted. And it's like, well, no, it's not just the rent control law. It's the Ellis Act, which actually means that landlords can just like evict tenants and sell up whenever they want. And that's an institutional thing. It's a legal thing. It's a regulatory thing. That would be different somewhere else. And so we do really need to have a careful examination of all of these laws to really understand the rental market. And that goes for any market, right?
Yeah. If the landlord can evict whoever they want, whenever they want, that's the default state of nature. That's not a rule that we have in place. If we made the rule that landlords couldn't evict people whenever they want, then that's a rule and that's bad. That'll cause problems. But the rule that they can evict people is not a rule. It's not a regulation. It's just how things are.
Yeah. That's the natural state of things. I think Marx talked about this, where he said something about what he called the vulgar economists, which I suppose is what we're talking about now. They said the institutions of capitalism are basically natural. They just existed for all time and place, and anything outside of them or anything new is deemed to be unnatural.
Rufus, Rufus, stop barking. What's gotten into you? All my farm animals are going, what? Something happening?
from the director of a very similar movie 2 years ago. Sir, you might want to take a look at this.
What's on the readout there?
That can't be right.
Got a problem, sir. The line go down.
The line is flat and down compared to inflation, right?
Look, it's definitely a line, and it's definitely going down.
Look out, the line's about to crash!
World leaders today have called an emergency meeting to discuss
pandemonium in the streets today. The line crisis reaches its third.
People everywhere are talking about line going
down. Dogs and cats barking and meowing and birds cawing in the sky.
Spectators around the world are glued to their screens thinking,
could line go up? Has line gone up?
Prices up. Unemployment up. Line down.
Hey, what's all the business about this line going down, eh? Have you ever seen line go down that much?
Yep, it's going down all right.
They say it's the end of the world. I don't know whether to buy or sell. If it keeps going down, I should sell, but if it starts going up again, then I should buy it.
I told them the line was going down. They didn't listen.
Oh yeah, I've been saying this for a long time. Watch out about that line.
Oh, it's okay, buddy. They'll stop line going down soon. It'll go up.
When? But when?
I don't know.
Protect you and your family from the line crisis with a line investment portfolio package.
I've never seen a line like this before.
Sometimes when the line go down this far, there's nothing left to do but pray.
A financial terrorist group has taken credit for the line goes down attacks, saying it will keep going more and more down until their demands are met.
If anyone can make it through line going down, it's you. I believe in you.
You keep quiet. There ain't no line going down, and there never was.
The line going up movement has stormed the Capitol.
The line's going down. Our expectations are becoming unmoored. We've lost credibility.
The supply and demand, they're all out of whack.
This is totally irrational.
Line. Look out! Look out!
Ah,
line is down!
Line's down! It's coming right for you!
Line's right behind me, isn't it? Dad, is there any chance that this whole line is made up bullshit that doesn't necessarily map to something real? Like now we're worrying about a graph or whatever?
No, son. Don't you ever say that again. I'd be embarrassed to have my son saying such a thing. Everyone will think we don't understand economics.
If we all believe, sir, could line go up?
Stupid, wretched boy. Back to your chamber.
The end of the line. Ignore what the critics are saying and see it this Friday. Line gonna go down. Line gonna go down.
There's so many great ideas that you talk about in this book, solutions to a lot of these problems. You talk about land taxing, public housing, community land trusts, UBI, companies required to have workers' councils. You talk about unitary taxation. So if companies operate in different countries around the world, they'd actually have to pay taxes within those countries. And you can't just use the international market as a way to avoid paying taxes. There's like solutions to so many of these problems that exist. But it feels like we're caught in this catch-22 where the game rules are already set up, and they're already set up to benefit the power of the ultra-wealthy. And so the ultra-wealthy have a lot of power over the game rules and how to change them.
I mean, it's politically, it's not easy. And I plead guilty at the end to saying, look, I don't actually have a political plan. I think all of this stuff would be really good, but we are up against some pretty powerful forces. Let's not deny that. But I think there's progress in a lot of these areas. We talked about antitrust. There have been a lot of rulings against this sort of anti-competitive behavior. You've seen people like Zoran Mandani getting elected in New York on a promise of rent control. His rent control policy is like, there's actually not that much to it. But everyone was talking about it. And he seems to be advocating for a lot of the ideas that I advocate for. And same with Zach Polanski and the Greens in the UK. Obviously, he hasn't been elected prime minister, but he's doing really well. And there are a lot of positive things going on. And there are, I think, a lot of victories that we can have. And so I do think that helplessness, the feeling of helplessness, is something which is really dangerous. And we can change things and make a difference. It has happened throughout history, and it like is happening again now. But I do think that sometimes with big P politics, people can get a bit discouraged, and sometimes maybe It's better to focus on things that are a bit more local, you know, unionizing your workplace or going to volunteer for some kind of cause, whether it's like activism or some kind of cooperative near you. Like I volunteer at a cooperative that's a credit cooperative that's not too far from me, even getting involved in local politics and things like that. But I just think that my hope for this book is that it has plenty of ideas for the people who are doing this type of thing. And, you know, in some small way, it seeps into that environment so that if people do get influence, if people do get power, then they can draw from this type of thing. I mean, I'm reminded of the Biden administration, which wasn't perfect, but they did draw a lot from some of the heterodox economics that I'm advocating, right? So things like modern monetary theory, things like Mariana Mazzucato and the entrepreneurial state, I think those were extremely influential during the Biden administration. And yeah, so some of these ideas I think can have an impact. So that's my kind of very long-winded way of saying I don't know exactly what we could do, but we can do something. And hopefully this book helps.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to be discouraged, and we're up against a lot of very powerful interests. But there are also reasons to be encouraged, and there are mechanisms to exercise power as like opaque and difficult to wedge yourself or any helpful person into as they are. Even you're mentioning the Biden administration, obviously not the beacon of socialist, social democracy stuff that we'd like to see, but Lina Khan, his chair of the Federal Trade Commission, who was going after a lot of these monopolies and stuff for the few years that she was in office there, is like really great. And everything I've heard her talk about in terms of her political priorities and what she wants to do is great.
Is.
I don't want to put too much faith in any of these people because you get let down a lot if you do that with social democratic politicians. But it is always nice to see. And in terms of local politics too, it can be like really encouraging to participate in that kind of stuff or to see changes in that area. We had a by-election in Vancouver last year where we got a socialist city councillor elected to the council. And that was like really exciting. Vancouver's municipal socialist party
right.
has existed for a long time and they've gone in and out of relevance. And yeah, getting someone on the council, it was really exciting, and we'll see what happens in the mayoral election. But also the thing you said about leaving the ideas around for people to pick up, I think is also really important. One of the things that made the Chicago School and some of those think tanks really powerful is that before they had a lot of influence, they were just churning out policy ideas and theory and leaving these things around for the people who agreed with them, who had power, to pick up on in the future and start implementing. Planting seeds, I think, can be really beneficial.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of the really good ideas are on the left. I mean, as dangerous as Trump's administration is, don't get me wrong, I'm not underestimating that. They don't have any ideas at all. They don't know what the fuck they're doing. That's obvious, right? That is completely incoherent. It's some kind of weird combination of like nationalism and Reaganism. It doesn't make any sense. And Musk, when he got in and he did Doge, and he did a lot of damage because he was a powerful idiot, but he didn't really know what he was doing, and that kind of unraveled, and it all catches up with them and they just don't really understand what's going on. Whereas you see someone like Mamdani, right, and hopefully this socialist guy in your council, he's going to have so much to draw from, right? There's such a rich tradition of ideas on the broad left, right, from anarchism through to democratic socialism or social democracy. There's so much there. And that's come, obviously, it has a long lineage, but it's come also since the financial crisis, since people were looking for alternatives to standard and mainstream economics. You've just seen so many great ideas, like, I don't know, the Green New Deal being one of them, right? You've seen a revival of interest in like worker democracy, co-ops, and things like that. You've seen all of these things. Wealth taxes are the main thing that everybody's talking about. And I would be surprised if a wealth tax doesn't end up becoming policy over the next like decade. I don't think it will be immediate, but I think it's probably going to happen. You know, the right don't have these ideas. The right don't have any real ideas. In one sense, that's really scary because they are still in power. But like, on the other hand, they can't deliver the goods for people. They can't deliver the outcomes that they're promising. And you're seeing that with things like the decline in Trump's approval rating as prices go up instead of down, because his ideas don't work.
I think the main solution you do offer in the book, it's maybe not like a specific single policy, but a general idea that I really agree with and really like, is the idea of governing the economy through demos or democracy. Unlike the political world, where people at least want to pay lip service to the idea of democracy and that everybody should have an equal say in the running of things, that idea isn't part of economics generally. And I think that integrating it, like theoretically, and then seeing how that moves through the world practically, if people had that same common sense that it's just as weird to have a boss at the top of a company telling everybody what to do who wasn't elected as it is to have a king at the top of a country telling everybody what to do who wasn't elected. Infusing democracy into the economic sphere, I think, is an important challenge and an important idea to get out there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's funny you're saying that to me. I do live in a country with a literal king, but
we have your king too.
He's a figurehead. Yeah, you do. You do technically, don't you? Yeah. But no, they don't. He doesn't tell everybody what to do in the way of the kings of yore. And people do regard that as something archaic and something that's intrinsically undesirable. And they think that there are all sorts of reasons that you shouldn't have government without consent of the governed. But I think that there are intrinsic reasons, right? People having control over their lives, people having input into the things that matter to them. There are also utilitarian reasons, right? There is, like, it might produce better outcomes. For example, if workers who generally know the job very well have a say over how things are done, have a say over how a business is run, right? If people have a say over the economy, then you can harness and utilize their knowledge and their expertise and their needs to make sure that the economy actually serves them. And you're right in saying that it's not a specific policy proposal. It's something that I actually got from, like, Ellen Mexins Wood, who talks about it in her book Democracy Against Capitalism. And yeah, she just says you need to revive this old spirit where you've got more participation, things like town hall meetings, votes. And I think Ireland actually had this recently, right, with their abortion referendum, or not too long ago, where they had, like, quite a lot of participation, and it was kind of almost like a jury service where a bunch of people were entrusted with studying and, like, making the decision, and they consulted a load of experts and things like that, and it was this kind of great democratic exercise. And I'd just like to see far more things decided in that way, because I think that, yeah, basically people, when they have a stake in something, they have an incentive to find out more about it, and when it matters to them, they're going to make better decisions, and they're not going to allow themselves to be, like, walked all over by the one person or group of people that are in charge. So that is fundamentally what animates a lot of the book, and it links back to inequality, because I don't think that you can have a demos when so many people have such a disproportionate amount of wealth and power.
Yeah, when people actually have a stake in things, it motivates them to care more and to have an opinion and to want to participate. Like, one of the arguments against democratizing the workplace you'll see is that a lot of people don't care. They just want to show up and go home, or they don't have the specific knowledge to do what the CEOs do. And it's like, we're not saying that nobody should be, like, a point person, or that there wouldn't be management roles or anything. But one of the major reasons you'll hear people in today's society and political democracy say that they don't vote, or they don't look into things, or they don't participate in the system, is because they, despite having a vote every however many years, don't feel like they really have much of a say, or that their voice really does matter. So they don't bother participating in it.
Yeah, the same argument used to be made about women not having the vote. It was like, they're not interested. Politics isn't their thing. And it's, to the extent that's true, it's probably because they don't have a say in it. So it's completely determined by, like, the extent to which people are allowed to participate.
So maybe one final question is, what do you think about the idea of an economy that entirely functions like a lending library, except it's not just for books, it's for everything, furniture, laptops. You can take it out, keep it as long as you are using it, bring it back for repairs, completely different economic motivations. Libraries, they're not trying to create as much stuff to shovel it out for as much profit as possible. They would lovingly care for these items like they do a book when they like tape up the tear on the cover so that more people can take it out and use that item in the future. So it seems to me there'd be a lot of optimization there, maximizing durability, modularity, energy efficiency, shared access, providing people with food, shelter, clothing, education, transportation, healthcare, bountiful opportunities to contribute through their labor and democratic participation. As an economist, would that make the graph go up, do you think? Would that be...
Yeah, library socialism is an idea which I don't think I heard until relatively recently over the past few years. And I do think that it's a really good model. Most people understand that a library is a place, a very nice place. That most people have good experiences of libraries. Most people understand that, yeah, okay, you might get a few people taking advantage or whatever, but for the most part, people take out books and they bring them back and it does work. So I do think that with a lot of things you could expand it to, right? Maybe you could talk about cars or maybe things like, I don't know, a drill, like kind of consumer durables, things that you only need every so often. And so you don't actually need to like have in your possession all the time. But yeah, I'm a massive fan of it. Whether it would make the line go up, it wouldn't, I don't think it'd count as economic output, would it? So I guess it would make the line go down. So
right,
and all that, despite everything I just said, we can't have it.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's economic opinion. That makes sense. It wouldn't work and it doesn't work. So the ones that exist now are just in the pre-failure period.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Aaron. I had a really good time.
One more time. If you want to get the book, go to the internet and type "Why We're Getting Poorer." And you will be able to find the book. You can purchase it and read it. And I recommend that you do.
There is a website that shows you a whole range of purchasing options that aren't Amazon. So you can find like a sort of Linktree-esque website. And you can find that quite easily from my YouTube channel, Unlearning Economics, as well. So wherever you are in the world, hopefully you can get one ordered to you. And it doesn't give Jeff Bezos any money.
Yeah, and Amazon has like the worst margins on their books, don't they? This is like a controversy in the author community that I see around that they, if you're not like exclusive to them, you get even worse margins. I don't know all the details, but yeah, I'll put a link to this website so people can buy it from non-Amazon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hello and welcome back to the Line Go Up Investment Podcast. We are your hosts who have just played the interview before on the tape player, not in a butt, and we're about to deliver that investment advice that you can start counting now. You can start counting those chickens before they hatch. You're part of our program.
You've got all the bases now covered, and this investment advice is about to hit hard.
Bing! So this is the sound of me Googling shrunken heads. Yeah, there you go.
What?
I just fucking Googled shrunken heads, dude. I'll take that tape out. Yeah, dude. Shrunken heads, it's actually fucking, our radar was right there. Now, I'll just read the AI one because it's simple. I'm sorry, Copilot search. We have an objection to the political economy of AI here at Line Goes Up Investment Podcast, but it's just kind of a simple, and I've verified through second sources is an accurate summary. Shrunken heads, known as Sansas, are human heads that have been severed, treated, and shrunk as part of ritual practices, primarily by the Jivaroan tribes of the Amazon rainforest. Boom. Not our lane.
I thought you were going to say that they had like a history of being used to like degrade people and something, but I mean, they probably have. I don't know if that's in the AI overview.
I'm curious to see what people have said about that kind of thing in the critical theory canon. I'm not prepared to speak on it, but I'm in the 1996 Goosebumps book, How I Got My Shrunken Head, a boy gets a shrunken head from his aunt that gives him jungle powers.
Jungle powers sounds off already.
So I'm glad I didn't use that metaphor, and I would never use that metaphor.
Yeah.
Except in a, that's a real culturally appropriate way.
Investment in your own correctness or like...
We got information that's going to help make it easier for us to live according to our values. And I think that's what critical theory is trying to do. Give people information that can help them live their values.
Yeah.
That's what I value about critical theory. Yeah. So apparently shrunken heads, they were the shrunken heads of their enemies. and they believe that it would prevent their soul from avenging them.
Nice.
I'm not saying I'm in favor of it necessarily. I don't know. There could be a place for it. I mean, what are we doing with the heads of our enemies otherwise? It's not. I'm just saying, if you're in some sort of life and death scenario, and this happens in many cultures, and hopefully we can avoid it all and get rid of it, and you can invest in that direction. But in the event that you do have people killing each other, is having a shrunken head of your enemy worse than just like letting their head rot on the side of the road?
In investment, you always have to keep your options open on things like that.
Right.
Make a decision when the time is right, but not before the time is right.
You have to be a trailblazer sometimes to go against the grain. Mm-hmm. But we're out of time and we have to get to this investment advice.
Yeah, you've waited long enough. The time is here. The advice is imminent. It's going to help. It's going to win.
Okay, just kidding. We're not an investment show.
Yeah, we don't really know what you should invest in, to be honest.
I wish you get some calluses on your hands. How about that?
What are those things called? That's my investment advice. Index funds? I guess you would invest in that, maybe?
Yeah.
If you want to be safe? I don't know.
Keep safe.
Don't ask
me. Got to keep public safety up by getting in those index funds.
We're
not
just
a high risk field.
And not even investment podcasts.
I'm running for office on a public safety platform of encouraging people to not get into high risk investing and instead get into reliable index funds. Don't over leverage yourself. Don't invest.
Don't put all your money into
flashy
Tesla or Bitcoin.
No, get a stable, from my understanding, something called an index fund or something like that. I can't remember exactly right now.
I think that's what it's called, and I think it's S&P and Dow Jones. And
something like that. It's like you invest in the economy as a whole. And
yeah, it's like a bunch of things mixed together or something. And
or better yet, how about invest in yourself?
Yeah, that's good investment advice, actually. Invest in yourself. Take some time.
Don't beat yourself up about it, but make progress. You know what
I'm saying? Learn a new skill or
swimming, cycling.
Even just have a rest or take some time to...
Oh, that's huge. If you're feeling frazzled, start there. Because that's both an investment in yourself and it's an incredible relief.
Look, you're the one who knows you best. And so if you're going to have a me night, ask yourself what you need and then you can invest... that.
Yeah.
You know, we could say, have a nice warm bath. And you'd be like, I just had a bath, so that won't help. And we'd be like, oh, you're right.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to give that advice.
Or any specific advice is what I'm arguing against here.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, that one in particular, though, stands out to me as a high risk. And there's other high risks, too. And we could list them and we should start listing them. So
yeah, maybe... cook a nice meal, have a nice nap, do some exercise. These are all things that you may have just finished doing and it would be irrational to advise you to do them again.
Or we could say try to increase your discipline, work on yourself. And I mean, you could be someone who's over-disciplined, who's working on themselves too much. And you need the advice to relax. Mm-hmm. You need the advice to step back or vice versa.
Yeah, you've been relaxing and relaxing. And we're just like, hey, advice,
you need
relax.
That push from a podcast. Parasocially, get up and start picking up that room. Cleaning is also a type of exercise. Get laundry in the hamper.
Everybody's different. You give one piece of it. I guess if you say in this situation you should do this, you can
say don't invest, spend gloriously for the good of all. Fuck investing. Oh, I'm gonna make predictions about the future.
And I say it depends on what. I don't know, but it does depend.
Oh, something you can invest in is the Seriously Wrong Patreon.
Yeah, that is an investment that helps the show.
It's not an investment in like a return on investment sense. I guess people kind of use investment as a metaphor here. There's a big gap there. Return on investment versus investing in things that don't provide a return.
Yeah.
Like,
I guess there's a type of return if you get enjoyment from the show and you're helping it continue.
Yeah, that's right.
But you'd be getting that return either way. No, not quite, because there's a bonus episode.
Yeah. So this has been the Seriously Wrong Podcast.
Been great to be on. Great to have this wonderful guest.
Everything's just great generally.
Yeah.
And doesn't it just make you smile when everything's great?
It does.
I know it makes me smile.
It truly does.
So I'm smiling right now just thinking about it.
You truly are.